Thank you, Brother Taylor. And I don't think there's anyone who is held in higher esteem within the brotherhood than Brother Taylor. I want to say, if you've looked at this program, I want to make it clear that though the program shows Tommy Hicks, and as was announced, I am not Tommy Hicks. Not to take anything at all away from Tommy Hicks, but if you know Tommy, you'll also know why I'm distinguishing myself from Tommy. But in any event, at the very last minute, so to speak, he let us know that it wasn't going to be possible for him to be here. He has to deal with some medical problems as far as his mother is concerned, and he also has an uncle that's having some problems, and so he was pretty much the only one that's in a position to be able to be of assistance to both of them, and so he sent his regrets, and very hastily, I've tried to put together from his manuscript or otherwise with regard to this particular topic. And I might indicate also that if you looked at the schedule, and here again, due to factors that no one could control, the lesson that should have gone just immediately before this one would have covered the first 19 verses of the ninth chapter of the book of Daniel. However, that was covered last night. So it would have helped if those had flowed right together. So I'm very gently excusing myself from any problems that occurs during the presentation, if you weren't catching it. In any event, we'll be looking at particularly the verses 20 on through the end of the chapter, which of course will be through verses 27. But even in thinking with respect to this, it's important to take note with regard to the first 19 verses and yet not going into detail with respect to them. It begins with the thought of Daniel being fully aware with regard to the ending of the 70 years that Jeremiah had spoken of, that was to be the period that the Israelites would be in Babylonian captivity. And as has been pointed out with respect to this, it's very likely that Daniel at this particular point in time would therefore most likely be somewhere in his 80s. And if he had gone into Babylon somewhere about age 14 or thereabouts, and being among the first to have gone, this would put him about the same age that I am, which I'm 84, and that ought to put him in about that same age category. And he's coming to the realization of this, and one of the things that struck me with regard to this, and especially taking note with respect to his age, is that the older you get, the more you recognize how much of history has gone on before you. And it's not a matter of necessarily having to read about it. It's something that you have lived through. And as a result, he no doubt could remember back to his some of his teenage years, no doubt, as well as before when he was in Jerusalem, and all of the problems that they were going through along with the besieging of the city, and being well aware with regard to perhaps even Jeremiah, and possibly having known him, perhaps having heard him, maybe having known Ezekiel, and certainly others of that would be even unknown. But here would be something of his background that he would be looking back to, and he would also have lived through the various changes that had taken place within the Babylonian Empire itself. And I think with regard to this, as I think with respect to the history of the past, say, 70, 80 years within this nation and within the world and the changes that have transpired. And sometimes we talk in terms of how, you know, you can't go back home, and there's a lot of truth to it, particularly if you wait very many years because of all of the changes that have taken place. And everybody has changed, even if everyone else has remained there. They've gotten older. Their habits and customs have no doubt changed. And the community has changed in a number of different ways, and that's been particularly true since World War II. And when somebody brings up, as I find out from time to time, with regard to even raising questions, when was the Civil War or when was World War II, and some of the people even in high school this day and time don't even hit any of that anywhere near close. But for those of us who lived through that time, we can very well remember when there weren't any of the interstate highways such as exist now. As a matter of fact, when I came down to Austin to take the bar exam, there wasn't any interstate highway. It was a two-way, one lane each direction. But that was 1958, well before some of you were born. But in any event, before World War II, this country was certainly predominantly, I'd say, agriculture. And so many of the young people that went into the service or otherwise moved into the cities for working in the factories, things of that nature, began to change the whole makeup. People normally would have traveled by bus or by train. If they had an automobile, they would very likely only have one automobile. But in any event, air travel certainly existed, but nowhere near what it is now. Very few people had ever traveled outside of this country, and many of them had never traveled very far from their home. Their roots were deep. You better not say anything against their state. You better not say anything against their community in which they lived, and certainly you better not say anything about their immediate family, maybe even some of their relatives otherwise, or you might find yourself in big, deep trouble. In any event, we will see how that things readily changed and not necessarily for the good. But here you see then that as Daniel is involved in this prayer that takes up the first 19 verses, that to a great degree he is looking back. And he's looking back to the way in which the Israelites had lived, and particularly with regard to the fact that they had departed from God. And certainly he would have been aware with regard to their overall history, which was one of constantly departing from God. But not only did he speak with regard to their sins, but he spoke with regard to his own as well. And he basically concludes that prayer with really thinking with regard to that of Jerusalem. And you might even take note with regard to the first or the last few verses relating to that prayer. And I'll just pick up with verse 16, where he indicated, O Lord, according to all thy righteousness, I beseech thee, let thine anger and thy fury be turned away from thy city Jerusalem, thy holy mountain, because of our sins and for the iniquity of our fathers. Jerusalem and thy people are become a reproach to all that are about us. Now therefore, O our God, hear the prayer of thy servant and his supplications, and cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate for the Lord's sake. O my God, incline thine ear and hear. Open thine eyes and behold our desolations and the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousness, but for thy great mercies. O Lord, hear. O Lord, forgive. O Lord, hearken and do. Defer not for thine own sake. O my God, for thy city and thy people are called by thy name. Now, I don't know. I think this is just another illustration of a great prayer. And as so often is no doubt mentioned, and we recognize that even Jesus' disciples asked that he teach them to pray, even as John taught his disciples. And we'd do a lot of good to go back and look at a lot of the great prayers that were prayed, and how heartfelt they were. Now, I recognize that for the most part, these were private prayers, and very likely when any of us pray in private and we're speaking with regard to those things that are very heartfelt, that the kind of language that we use, even if we're not verbally expressing it, is probably far different than that which we hear when the prayers are prayed in the way of a public prayer, perhaps during a worship service. But we need to be more mindful with regard to those public prayers as well, with the realization that so many times we're using cliches, other well-known, well-worn phrases that may or may not be coming from the heart of the individual. And God's very well aware of that. But you want a prayer that is very, very one that comes from the very depth of the heart. Here is one. And I'm sure that there wasn't anybody else that was hearing it other than God. Now, in the 20th verse that we're actually picking up with, he tends really to sum up pretty much what was in the prayer. And that is, he says, "And while I was praying," or speaking, "and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God and for the holy mountain of my God." And you'll notice for one thing, he's constantly speaking of it as being mine, even when it comes to the Israelite people, that he has certainly recognized their sinfulness, but even in the process of doing so, he's speaking of them as being his people. And you notice also that a part of the prayer, and it's otherwise reflected, but again, this seems to be something of a summation with regard to the prayer of what's including, and that is it's of what he is making a plea for. And you notice that the first thing that went into this prayer was really a realization of their sinfulness. It wasn't starting out by, "Here's what I want," or "How good I have been, here's what you owe me," or anything of that nature. It's not preaching a prayer of or preaching a sermon to God or reminding him of past scriptures or anything of that nature. He's pouring out his heart with regard to the sins of the people. And also, though, mind you, it's been all those many years since he has been in Jerusalem, his heart is still back there. And he's still very much concerned with the well-being of his people and of the nation of Israel, the temple, and that whole area. And this is certainly a very fine admonition with regard to our attitude today. Now, certainly we don't have a holy city, we don't have a temple, anything of that nature, of the physical nature. And yet we do have a homeland. And with respect to that, we're expected to honor the law. We're expected to respect those who are in positions of authority. We're expected to pray for them and to treat them with the proper respect. And that's exactly what Daniel was doing, again, though recognizing the great differences that existed. But nevertheless, this is the kind of heartfelt feeling that hopefully comes forth from us as we consider our needs, the needs of this nation, and the needs of the world. And recognizing that just as God was the solution then, he's the solution today, just as much as then. It's just that we have the realization of Christ and the hope of salvation, and we're not just looking for anything that's of an earthly nature, but rather we're looking for that heavenly home. What we notice here is while he's still praying, Gabriel, and he speaks of him as the man Gabriel, and I think this is just an expression indicating that he was in the form of a man. I don't think there is any suggestion whatsoever that he was actually a man rather than a heavenly being, but rather, again, he's presented as Gabriel coming to him in the form of a man. And he says also that he had seen him before. Well, if you go back to the previous chapter in about verse 16, you'll find mention with regard to where Daniel was and how that Gabriel had spoken unto him and given him a vision that he was to understand. Time-wise, probably would have been about 5 years previous to this. But nevertheless, it was something that very clearly was still very much in his mind. You notice something else with respect to this, that he has come, according to the King James, he has come swiftly, and that he touched him about the time of the evening oblation. Now, clearly, as far as any evening oblation was concerned, Jerusalem no longer existed as a city, having been previously destroyed, and was nothing more than rubble. But nevertheless, this was still something in the mind of Daniel, and this was a time that he chose to pray. We also notice that he was touched. And it sounds like then a physical touching by Gabriel, which might give the impression, and don't want to assume too much in anything, so many times we are inclined to do it and we can just as easily be wrong. We aren't told of the position that Daniel was in at the time that he was praying. He may have been kneeling, he may have been prone upon the ground, but I at least would think that he was very much concentrated on what he was praying about. And it's not like someone walking into the house and you hearing a door open or close, or you hear footsteps, but that Gabriel is suddenly there and he touches him, thus getting his attention, which again might suggest something with regard to the concentration of Daniel in the process of his prayer. And we're told he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. And I think even that within itself would suggest that this was going to be perhaps something that would be a bit difficult, that he was going to assist Daniel with respect to this. And particularly in verse 23, notice something else where he says, at the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to shew thee, for thou art greatly beloved, therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. Now here is again the thought that we find otherwise expressed, how that it's the fervent prayer of a righteous man that avails much. Here is a man that is being told very clearly by Gabriel that you're a very beloved individual. And how quickly did he get a response from his prayer? Well, he's in the midst of the prayer, whether it's the beginning of the prayer itself or when he indicates at the beginning of thy supplications at that particular point in the prayer, but whichever it is, immediately there was a response. I think that's, again, some indication with regard to the relationship that Daniel had with God and how quick God can and does respond at times. There are occasions, and even for perhaps during a time such as this, when number gathering from various places and people are traveling and there are the prayers that they might arrive safely without difficulties and likewise be able to return home to their families without difficulty of any kind. And lo and behold, most of the time that's exactly what happens. Hopefully we remember to give thanks for it. It might not take much of anything more than a person, say if they're driving and they ended up leaving a minute or two later than they intended to, or a minute or two earlier, unknown to them, had they left at a different time, they might have been in a horrible accident that would have taken their life. We never know with the hand of God being involved. I can remember one individual telling some years ago, just have to take his word for it, that he was getting ready to take a flight on an airplane. And I don't know whether he had gotten on the airplane actually or was just getting ready to, but for some reason or other, he decided he wouldn't. You know, he didn't have any vision or anything of that nature, but in any event, he didn't take the flight. It just so happened he learned later that that aircraft had crashed and there had been a loss of a lot of lives. Was God's hand involved? I don't know. But it made a lot of difference as to whether he was on the aircraft or not. So many things that we simply are not aware of. And here again, God shows his presence and his actions over and over again in the lives of men and in the lives of nations. Now, as we begin to get into the message with regard to the 70 weeks, let me say from the beginning that if you look in any number of commentaries, you're going to find all kinds of writings with respect to it. And a matter of fact, you very easily, in some of them, you find pages and pages and pages and pages. And even if you read all of it, you may ultimately wonder, did they ever decide what they thought that this meant? So that I'm saying this in part because although I've read through it many times over the years, certainly as far as having the time to before this presentation to spend much time with it, I haven't. And at the same time, hopefully that will end up making some sense, but it's with the recognition that just as so many of these scholars have not been able to come to any definite opinion with regard to it, I'm putting out some of these thoughts for just whatever you think that they may be worth, and hopefully you'll go back and study it even more for yourself, even if you do not come to any of the same sort of thoughts that I might put forth. What we have, of course, is 70 weeks, which is the total number of weeks that are being addressed, and generally speaking, it's thought of as being in terms of each day, each time that we're talking about representing a year. So a total of 490 years that we're really talking about. And so it is that this 24th verse would seem to sort of sum up the totality of all that's going to be covered during that period. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people and upon thy holy city to finish the transgression and to make the ends of sin and to make reconciliation for iniquity and to bring in everlasting righteousness and to seal up the vision and prophecy and to anoint the most holy. Now, all of that within itself would seem to therefore encompass a very large period of time and would seem to not only take them from that present time or shortly thereafter, but all the way up into the time of Christ and the anointment it speaks of, the most holy. So if this is basically covering the entire time frame, then otherwise we're primarily looking to see just how that time might be broken out. And I'll simply read through the balance of the verses and then come back and spend a little time with respect to what has been indicated. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the command to restore and to build Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the prince shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now you might notice right there you're talking about 69 of those weeks. And the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous times. And after 62 weeks, you've noticed 7 weeks have been not addressed, included in that, shall the Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations, and he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. Well, again, just in going back to some of this, he speaks with regard to the command that goes forth to restore and to build Jerusalem. Well, there's at least three different commands that went out. The first one that we would be inclined to read about would have been there in the book of Ezra, as we have with regard to Cyrus. And that would have been about 536. a little bit later, as we know, with regard to how the letters were written back and the work was stopped, and ultimately then another letter came back saying to resume, and that letter again had to do with the rebuilding, and that would have been about 515. And then if we get into Nehemiah, we've got the instruction as Nehemiah there in the second chapter, as he was the king's cupbearer, and he was authorized to go back, and he took letters from the king, and this gave authorization for the work that was to be done and the material that could be furnished. And this would put us into about 445, somewhere in that neighborhood. So oftentimes the thought is that when we're talking about this first period of 7 weeks and the letters being sent out, that it may not be precise in that respect, or necessarily even one letter, but possibly could consider primarily the period then of 49 weeks or 49 years and encompass the period of Ezra and Nehemiah and that effort to rebuild, but in any event, putting it into that time frame. When you're looking at the larger period of time that is there, of 62 weeks, we, of course, are possibly looking, as some would put it, that interim period from the rebuilding of Jerusalem on up to the time of the coming of Christ. And here again, as far as trying to put a correct time to it, and talking with Tommy Hicks even with regard to this, as he had written his manuscript, and you know, he was of the realization as well that he was, you know, having difficulty in trying to say, well, this began exactly at this year and ended at exactly the next year, certain time frame, so as to be all that precise with regard to it. So in any event, all I'm going to say with regard to it, it seems very likely that this would have been, as portrayed, it was going to be a time that would be a troublesome time. And certainly that was the case throughout this period. And there was the various nations that would rise and fall, which Daniel had already spoken of, and the nation of Israel in its destructive nature was nevertheless always right in the center of a lot that that would otherwise occur. And the Maccabeans during that time and the revolt that they were such a great part of, all of this being a part of very, very troublous times in which all of this would have been occurring. There is the mention also then with regard to that one last week that exists, and also the mention with respect to the Messiah being cut off. And certainly there's some difficulty in dealing with that. And mentioned at least one of the thoughts with respect to that one last week is that it possibly related to the time that encompassed both John the Baptist and Jesus. And here again, I can't help but make mention that it's very, very difficult to begin to think in terms of nailing this down precisely. What you do also get within verse 26, and this speaks with regard to a prince, but this prince would not seem to be that of Christ. It said, "The people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall call the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of the abominations he shall take shall make it desolate." Well, here again you can see what might be a combining of several thoughts. And a part of that being, with respect to that of the destruction that was to take place, would be perhaps looking forward to the destruction of Jerusalem by Titus in A.D. 70. But also, when speaking with regard to the causing of the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, while certainly we would recognize that that would have physically been true at the time that Jerusalem and the temple was destroyed, we would also, however, recognize that from a spiritual standpoint, it had terminated with the old law as Jesus was nailed to the cross and the old law came to an end. So it is that a number of factors, therefore, might very well be covered, and again, recognizing the difficulty that is there in trying to pin down some of the preciseness. And again, I'm not by any means suggesting that you take what I have indicated and say, well, that has to be the case. I suggest you go back and study it more fully for yourself, and certainly I need to do that as well. But in any event, as we look over this, we cannot help but see once again the hand of God, as He is so deeply involved in the affairs of men, and there is no question that He is going to bring about all that He has spoken of, and He will give even Daniel a greater insight into those things that are going to occur than we have touched on already. It should do nothing more than cause us to have a greater trust in God, deeper faith in Him, a greater desire to serve Him faithfully, and to be a part of those who help to carry out His will, rather than standing either idly on the side or of being those who will oppose Him. And the only way we can adequately do that is, of course, for us to continue to study His Word and to then, to the best of our ability, strive to live according to His will. Certainly, Daniel sought in every way to do it, and God showed His great love for him in the manner in which He revealed so many of these things to him. With that, I leave the thoughts with you for this afternoon.